Hello, this is Chaz from Quiet Speculation, and you're listening to the QS Cast. If you're a QS subscriber, you're hearing this as soon as it gets published. If you're not a subscriber, you had to wait a few days. If you want to listen to the podcast as soon as it's published, or you just want to know more about Quiet Speculation, go to quietspeculation.com/tour and check out everything we have to offer. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the QS Cast. We have a great cast this week. A really esteemed guest here. We said, Tarkan and I, we wanted to get as many vendors on as we can. So this is going to be one of those weeks that we were alluding to. Avram Oliver from Adventures On is joining us. You don't really need an introduction, but I will give it to you anyway. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Chaz is so excited he actually forgot to give me a little introduction as well.
Slacking. What's up, Tarkan?
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Avram, so excited to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us. Seriously, it's an honor.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's really nice of you guys to take your time and have me on.
So, Tarkan, why don't you start us off? Avram, you have some great notes, and we'll try to get through this as efficiently as we can. So let's just jump right in.
Yeah. I think Avram, maybe the best way to start is to just kind of introduce the store. Many of us that work with QS or that are part of QS are familiar with Adventures On, but a lot of people probably aren't who are going to end up listening to the cast. So maybe you can just tell us about, your store, how you started. You were kind of a hotbed for some major pro players, including, LSV, Luis Scott Vargas, and Shahar Shenhar. And, maybe you can kind of just tell us a little bit about the background of Adventures On and how everything sort of came to be.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I started the store Adventures in Comics and Games in the Sacramento, California area in 1993. We actually got into Magic about the third or fourth shipment of Unlimited. It was actually pretty hard to get, started getting really popular. And we just really embraced the playing and the supporting of it. And we started doing tournaments almost immediately and just really providing as many singles and play knowledge and play space as possible. Then I started, meeting a lot of really good players and just culminating, having a real destination place. Actually knew a few of the original pros that kind of did a few things early in the game. Unfortunately, not all of them were good. One gentleman, he actually kind of invented one of the first, type one decks. And then another gentleman who I won't say his name, but actually was the first pro player to get banned for a year. So, that was kind of interesting. Then, I met, Luis and started working with him on sponsorship when I was dealing, I started dealing online with Adventures On and joined, several different vendor sites and doing, pretty much the typical thing that you see these days is a lot of online vendors. Really neat thing was just actually playing the game with the players, helping them, taking an interest in them and giving them the opportunity to go as far as they wanted to go. And I get to see, LSV do amazing with the game. And Char started when he was 14 playing in the store, and he'd, come in every day and, read everything online and just put so much effort into it. It was just really neat to see, the whole community come together, and seeing a lot of my players make it to the Pro Tour over the years. So it just, kind of, it's not just a business, it's also a community. And, I'm part of that. And it's just a real pleasure to do it. I actually have been a price guide advisor on and off for, did Inquest Gamer Magazine for years. And then also, support some of the online sites for price guides as well.
That's crazy cool. Yeah, I remember Inquest. I used to use that all the time. It's really interesting, guys. I know that they had a small, I think it was like a small basket of merchants that would sort of provide input as to what the pricing was years ago. I mean, this is way back in the day. This is back in like the 90s. So that's really interesting. And then what about now your relationship with Black Border? Can you tell us a little bit about BlackBorder.com and kind of the relationship you have with them and what you provide exactly? Yeah.
Basically, they're a price guide website. Providing content as well. And then the price guide itself, obviously prices are subject to a lot of details, a lot of, supply and demand and perception. And the reality is what can I go get the cards for right now? Not what can I find one card on, eBay for, once. That's not a real, you know, that's not a market. The market is ebb and the flow. And so I've kind of tried to help them really stay in touch with, you know, what the active, you know, trending prices are. And obviously, you know, I'm just a part of that, but it's a great site and it's been a really good relationship. Actually, that was who we worked with LSV with when he first started, you know, doing more of the online things. You can actually search the archives for the Black Border show with LSV. Have all the all the records up there.
I didn't even realize that. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't even realize they were doing content for Blackboard. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, LSV used to come up to the shop twice a week and film the Blackboarder show and then play in the tournament. And that was a lot of times when he would play with Shahar when he was first getting started. And Louis said to me that, you know, he really liked coming to those tournaments because he wasn't guaranteed to make top eight, which is a pretty big, you know, compliment coming from him because he's always been such a competitive player. And the fact, you know, we would have, you know, anywhere from 20 to 30 players regularly. But, you know, you think he would completely dominate. He just mostly dominated, you know, just wasn't always guaranteed top eight. So it was kind of nice to, you know, to really kind of see the level of competition was really high.
So you really do have that, like you said, just using your words, just a store. It did start out as like a community, and not many stores really can pull from that rich history like that. Do you feel that that's been advantageous for you this whole time?
Yes, yes. Yeah. But it's just like with anything, you get back what you put into it. And, you know, people actually, they talk to me and they find out, I'm like, you know, what can I help you with your deck? You know, how's it working? You know, working with them a strategy, you know, I've sat down and played with people for years. And that right there is, it's part of why it's a community, you know, and that's important. Not everybody can do that, but it's something I just really enjoy. I love the game and I love the players.
So speaking to that relationship, as it relates to kind of, you know, the customers, you know, vendor customer relationship, maybe you can tell us sort of your approach, Adventures On approach, as to just, you know, how you position yourself in the marketplace, you know, how you approach your buy lists, your policies, things like that, to kind of illuminate a little bit more for the listeners.
Well, the goal is to try to stock as many of the cards as possible, not just as for business sense, but once again, going back to, you know, if a player needs a card, they need the card. They want the card to play with, the test with, you know, proxies are fine, but they don't do the same thing. They don't, you know, it's really not the same thing. You need to have the cards. You want to complete your deck so you can play. If you have access to everything, you can do the best you can. And so our buy list is actually designed to target the hot cards, the playable cards, those cards for all the different formats that people need to really kind of get into it as deep as they would like to and to keep evolving into the game. And so obviously, you know, it is a business, we have to make money. And so, you know, we try to offer, you know, premium price for the premium cards at the moment. And then for the cards that are just long-term, you know, staple playables and cards that we feel have longer potential, because as a player, I have a little bit of insight into, you know, wow, this is an amazing card. I did this in draft or this in sealed. You know, I remember when this was, you know, an old standard, you know, back even before standard, when it was just a tournament deck, I remember these cards were amazing. Well, what stopped them from being amazing? So, you know, those are the types of things I'm going to make sure I keep on my buy list.
Interesting. And what about grading? I know that, you know, I can say from experience, and just to touch on this, that I use your buy list all the time. I don't know if you've seen some of my stuff come in, but it's frequent. Yes. I usually send you guys a lot of stuff.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I do recommend anyone, if they want, you know, definitely check out Adventures On buy list. They offer some really great pricing. But one thing I noticed, that you have some interesting things. You offer a slight bump if everything comes in as it's supposed to come in, as you submitted in the buy list, which is, maybe you can talk to that. And also, I've noticed that you do something that is very kind of unique from a lot of other buy lists, in that your team will send me a response back saying, hey, we've got your list, and you know, you have some cards in here that are kind of played, but that's okay. We're going to give you full value, which is really, really, really a real courtesy. And it's really something interesting that a lot of other vendors don't do. There's, you know, a lot of vendors can be quite strict, but you guys say, you know what, we have this gradient of flexibility, and you know, yeah, maybe a percentage of your cards are a little bit played, but that's okay. We're going to give you full value. And I think that's a huge customer service move that you guys do. And maybe you can just talk a little bit about that.
Definitely. Yeah, no, we appreciate when people take the time to use our buy list. It's fairly automated. And once you get used to it, it's pretty quick, but it's still a lot of work to go through all of your cards and compare what you have, what you want to get rid of, and then to check the condition and everything. And, you know, you prepare everything up. If you manage to get everything, you know, really, really just lined up. I mean, there's basically four things you do. If you can get them all correct, you get a 5% bonus because we appreciate you saving us that time and effort because the processing time is so fast when it's done correctly. And that's why we add that 5% because essentially you save us money. Let's give you that more money for that extra work you did. And the flexibility on the condition. Now, this is where it can, unfortunately, some people have tried to take advantage of that over the years. But for those people who don't, and for instance, you never have. I actually always like to see, you know, a package come in with your name on it because I know that there's integrity in how it was done. You know, there's the best of intentions are really valuable. And I try to reward that. And that's why, you know, as long as it's reasonable amount of the lower, you know, valued cards are, you know, a couple of, you know, a little bit of LP here, you know, occasionally there might be something that's a little bit more seriously wrong, but it's not a major impact to our time or the value, then we're just going to go ahead and accept it as is. We're going to facilitate it. It goes faster. There's less labor in handling it. So once again, you've made it easier on us. You've made it more cost effective for us. So we're going to, you know, show our appreciation for your time and effort and for helping us make money, you know, by being realistic about it. There are times, you know, especially now that the market is kind of pushing the conditions around a little bit. Near mint has been pushed closer to mint, you know, lightly played is now getting closer to what near mint used to be. And the average, you know, player and collector still want near mint, and they may not realize that by avoiding lightly played and it's making it harder to sell cards. So, you know, occasionally we do have to make a lower offer because of this. And then also if somebody just is not familiar with grading, which can happen. I mean, not everyone is trying to abuse us for our good nature. Sometimes they just don't know any better and they expect us to make a lower offer. But some, you know, sometimes some of the investors out there getting a little pushy and really kind of sending HP and MP and even water damage stuff in, expecting us just to accept it.
Interesting.
So we're getting into that discussion. And like I said, I'm kind of familiar with the service too. And that certainly makes you stand out amongst the rest. Can you maybe talk a little bit more about just being a large vendor in the current market as more of a meta perspective? And is it becoming more difficult? Because I know we're kind of leading into that direction. And how, maybe talk a little bit more about how, like when you jumped into that kind of online space and the online versus the LGS, just being a specific brick and mortar, like what, how, maybe talk about the pros and cons a little bit.
Initially, we just had such a large stock built up. I mean, I know that sounds like an amazing thing, but being a player and a collector myself, and then just supplying so much over the years, I was able to create a large local market along with, you know, many other stores that it came and go, you know, came and gone over the years. But I had this huge inventory, and I started supporting, you know, some online stores, help kind of, you know, put at least one person on the map who unfortunately is no longer around. And then it allowed me to get bigger and really start to do it myself. And then, you know, I joined Black Border as the, you know, as a vendor on their site. And then I ended up launching, you know, Ventures on myself. And then that was when I started sponsoring, you know, LSV and Paul Cheon and then, you know, Shahar for a while. And even Patrick Chapin actually designed and printed one version of the Ventures on shirts. The black one with the red logo was actually made by Patrick Chapin. And it's kind of an interesting thing. I've got a lot of names
that's
to
awesome.
Drop. Yeah. But it was a natural progression because, you know, the store you know, you have the access to the singles. It's like I'm every day I'm at my own Grand Prix, you know, obviously not that large, but it's the same type of thing. There's always a lot of activity going on. And because I'm always trying to support the players, they're always coming in and trading what's at the shop and buying and selling. And we've always offered, you know, some of the best prices on boxes, not just because, you know, we want to sell them and make money. It's because we want to get the product out there into the marketplace. And by supporting the marketplace, it'll support you. I've always referred to that as the economy of magic. And if you support the economy of magic, you'll make money. Doesn't matter what level you're at. If you're at a store, if you're at just an online vendor, if you're a backpack trader, you know, if you go to, you know, the bigger tournaments, if you're interacting with that, whatever level you're on, you can make money and you can afford to play if you support it. But it is getting more difficult, you know, if you really want to make the quick buck, because the trends are just coming and going so fast, the price spikes and the buyouts and the manipulation. But realistically, if you want to do well, you know, having a store is a good thing, but you have to support the community and you have to protect the community. You have to watch out for people coming in and, you know, being basically predators on your players and undercutting you and taking your business. And it's kind of like with online, it's the same thing. There's everybody selling cards now. There's quite a few marketplaces as well as eBay that everybody can offer their products at. So it's harder to buy because everybody can offer direct now, but they can't provide the service, or they don't provide the service because it costs money. So realistically, by supporting the game and the community, that's the best way to make money, because it comes back to you. And it's not just because it's a business. First, it's because you enjoy it and the community aspect. And then it becomes a business because you're supporting others and then they're supporting you. And that's the really important part to me. And I know that may sound kind of, you know, a bit altruistic, you know, but really that's what it is. Because how many times have you heard somebody say, I didn't know what to play at this event and a friend gave me this deck and I won with it? Read articles about it. You hear about it at large events. Without the support and the availability of the cards, we wouldn't have this wonderful game. So I know it's, once again, yeah, not exactly what you expected to hear there. But.
No, honestly, it really wasn't. I have to say that's a pretty unique perspective, and one that you definitely don't hear all too often. And we've had other vendors on here before, so I really do appreciate.
No problem. I think you'd be surprised. More people actually believe it. They just don't realize that that's how it's all connected and that's how it works.
Curious though, I'm just kind of curious from a nuts and bolts perspective though, and because when you talk about this sort of being a piece of the engine of this economy, right?
Yes.
I shouldn't say realistic. Obviously, you can do it, but do you think the marketplace is still supporting the LGS that wants to grow, expand? Does that model still, I mean, LGS open all the time, but many of them close all the time too. And compared to maybe even, well, let's go far back as even 10 years ago, obviously things have evolved so much. As from a business model perspective, do you think the LGS route is really the best way to go? Because when you were starting, I mean, I remember like the LGS was, I mean, that was the hub. That was where all the action happened as far as this economy, but things have moved online so much. Would you recommend to someone that they start an LGS, a brick and mortar, or would you suggest establishing a robust online presence first, then maybe exploring that?
I believe it's a chicken before the egg type of thing. You have to have the market. You have to have access to your piece of it, or what part you're interacting with to build on. And an LGS is a great way to do it if you're knowledgeable in the game, you have an area that has players, that needs players, that you can support. Also, I had mentioned the protecting of the environment. There's a lot of backpack vendors will come in and undercut you and actually take the collections away from you and, you know, basically operate their businesses in your business. Nobody can survive with that. Over the years, part of the way I've survived is to either, you know, figure out who those people are and go, you can't do that here, or get rid of them if they wouldn't stop. But honestly, by supporting, pretty much, I think anybody can do this. If they actually support the game and carry the game and still can keep it a business and friendship with the players, I think they can really build something great. It's just not everybody can do that, because it's difficult to be both a businessman and somebody's friend. You know, and to me, a friend isn't going to ask me to hurt myself for them. And so the best friends that I've made over the years are from my store. And I don't regularly have them go, oh, you need to give me this deal, or you have to give me a better deal. It's, you know, hey, Avram, how are you doing? You know, do you want to play this game? You want to play this game? If they need something, they'll give me an opportunity to help them out, you know, and if I can offer them a good deal or I can get them what they need, they're more than happy to give me the business. But we have that separation. But once again, going back to supporting, basically the stores are where people start to play for real. They're where they learn how to play, where they get their initial singles in their product. And without that, I think the game will die long term. Starting online is the hardest thing to do, because then you don't have that connection with your customers. You don't have that draw. You're just one of many, you know, blank faces out there going, buy my cards, sell me your cards. You don't build right. that relationship. And as you had mentioned, that I offer some services that other vendors don't, they're not just to be a nice guy. They're also because, like I said, you work hard to sell me something. I'm going to show you my appreciation for that. You saved me money by doing this work. I'm going to give you a little bit more. It's give and take. It's that sharing of responsibilities, and that, once again, going back to the community, that's what allowed me to start with the LGS and work my way up online. It's just progress. I mean, I made progress because of all these things and opportunities that came along, and now there's a lot more opportunities. You just have to be able to make it with the overhead. Overhead is killer, that's for sure. So
it sure is. It sure is.
Labor of love is what comes to mind. But anyways, that's how I feel about that.
Sort of switching gears here, and you did touch upon this, that there is that section of the market. Can you maybe have some thoughts on making money in Magic, like the thoughts on Magic finance, quote unquote, and Magic as an investment vehicle?
I think so, yes. I actually started making a lot of money on what is now Commander years and years ago. And that was because people, you know, they wanted these cards. They wanted to have fun with them. They enjoyed them. What was good? That was a great investment. Also, you know, rarities, you know, if you want a very specific investment advice, rarities right now are a very real investment. You know, obviously, first with what you enjoy, what everybody enjoys, that because they're not gonna just let go. The reason why Commander, or Elder Dragon Highlander, as it was originally called, has driven so many prices is because the people, they don't generally stop playing it, and they don't break up their decks, and they don't get rid of cards, you know, as almost a rule. Some people do, but for the most part, if they really enjoy it, they're going to hold on to it. So that's value right there. So if you collect what you enjoy, what other people enjoy, it's always a good investment. But that's for medium to long term. Short term, you look for, you know, like I said, rarities, things that are kind of under the radar. Don't necessarily go for buyouts, because that's unfortunately really doesn't work out, because if there's more cards out there and they go up in value, everybody just puts them up for sale, and that drops the price back down if the demand is not true. There's a few things like anthologies, Battle Royale, Beatdown, Deckmaster, even the Cold Snap theme decks. Then there's Starter. There's some really odd things that not a lot of people know about. Like, for instance, 8th edition had its own little subset of cards that you could only get in the two-player starter that came for the game. And so they're actually part of 8th edition, but they have a subset, I believe it's 7 cards, and they'll say S1 out of S7 on it. And I actually regularly have major other vendors restock those 7 cards for me, even though they're horrible play cards. They're just so scarce that if anybody wants them, they have to pay a premium price for a common that isn't even that playable. So, I mean, there's lots of opportunities out there for investment. But, you know, like I said, tried and true ones are the good playable cards that people enjoy, that they're likely to hold on to. So, you know, you want to be careful about investing too heavily in Standard, unless that card is good enough to be played in Modern and Legacy potentially. in Pauper, you know, EDH. That's what you really want to look for, is long-term playability, rarity, and things that people are going to want to hold on to. So I know I didn't name any specific card names, but that those things right there have always done well and will always continue to do well.
So I have to say, Avram, there's so much that it packed in what you just said that I kind of want to go into. And hopefully we have enough time, and maybe we can't go into all of it, but there's so many things going in my head when you were speaking that I want to touch on. So maybe we can just start with a few things. So first of all, very interesting thing here, and this kind of relates back to your buy list, because the one thing that I've noticed about your buy list is you have incredible prices on the Commander supplemental singles. I end up shipping you most of my stuff that comes from like Commander 2013, 14, all these supplementals. You have some incredibly competitive pricing. So that seems to align with this sort of philosophy of, you know, the EDH crowd is where there's a lot of potential. So Chaz and I generally, we actually have, I don't want to say it's a different philosophy, but it's a different approach. We sort of sit on the marketplace with what's been going on and with reprints and all these things. You don't really, there are some things that are medium to long term, but I generally, and I think Chaz also believes in this, go for things that are very short term. I get something in and I immediately get it out. I'm sort of a turn and burn, and I feel like, at least from the ground level, that's where a lot of this magic finance or the market is moving towards. However, you just said here, it's interesting to hear, you sort of have a more longer term approach, and you think that there's still a lot of value in that. So it sounds like from what I'm hearing from you is that casual cards and buying into casual cards and sitting on them, even with the threat of reprint, is actually okay, and that this sort of philosophy of medium to long term is still viable. Is that true?
Yes. The short term pays the bills, which is very important. You can't ignore that. And if you are, as you're setting aside cards, you're paying attention to the market trends, and something goes up above, you know, by a certain percentage of what you paid for it, definitely turn it over, make your money. It's important. Once again, the economy of magic must be obeyed. And that is, you've got to eat and you have to be able to buy more cards and you have to be able to play. Playing, you can't replace playing, because it will just, you'll play something new and go, oh my God, I have to have 100 of these. And you can make a ton of money on that on the short term. But once you have set aside cards long enough and you don't turn everything over, they become a resource that you can draw from over time as something goes up. Like, look at Tarfire right now, just, you know, what, 5 times within a couple of days in price. And so I go back into what I call my archives, pull out a few hundred of them, and I've got the most of them available right now. And I'll do that because I've been setting aside things for years and not just blowing it out given the first opportunity. It's one of those things, you have to turn, but you have to be careful. You know, is it going down? Is it going to rotate? And that's why it's no longer going to be worth anything. Or can I hold into a little bit and just either sell it in pieces, trying to, you know, make a little bit more over time as it continues to go up, or not? You know, I've even invested in, collecting some really oddball sets myself. Like, I actually forgot to mention alternate fourth edition. Been collecting it for 20 years and still haven't managed to build a set of it. But it's a long-term, you know, process sometimes. You don't make money on everything right away. You just can't be afraid to sit on it either. I don't know. It's hopefully you feel I addressed your question there.
Yeah, it really comes with some discretion, right? Like, to evaluate.
Hello?
Yeah, yep, we're here.
Okay. Sorry. Sounded like you cut off there.
What's interesting to me is that you know, because you mentioned these really, really unique products, which I totally understand. I'm more curious, and just really quick, if you can specifically address, okay, I buy into a Commander staple.
Yes.
These days, the threat of it getting reprinted is particularly high. I mean, the track record of Wizards is that they're not afraid, and they've even publicly stated they're going to aggressively reprint things. So are you suggesting that the casual cards, even if they get reprinted 3 times, they're still going to, long term, you anticipate that the majority of them will still see gains over time? as I sit on the other side, where I generally think that if something is in threat of being reprinted, in fact, it could be reprinted multiple times, you kind of want to get out of it sooner than later. But so I'm really interested in this perspective you have of that. You don't really need to worry about that so much, because I would like to sort of hear how your philosophy there on that, because
my philosophy on it is, why is it worth something in the first place? Look at Sol Ring. Sol Ring now at this point has been reprinted in every single Commander deck for each release, and it's still a solid $2 to $3 card. Now that is, you know, has the most playability for what it is than pretty much anything else that hasn't been banned. So that's a good example of something that is always going to have demand because it's just so playable. Everybody's going to have one in every single deck. If you look at another card, it only has one printing. It's in a deck that doesn't see a lot of play, or an archetype that doesn't see a lot of play, but it's worth a tremendous amount of money because it was printed at a time in a rarity that just wasn't available. Well, if that gets reprinted once, okay, it's going to drop a little bit. Gets reprinted twice, it's going to tank, unless it was reprinted as a mythic rarity in something like one of the sets that they did ultra limited. Like, for instance, the Commander, I apologize, there was the ultimate collection they did for Commander. I always forget the rest of the name because most
people don't talk about it.
Not the anthologies. It was the premium.
Commander Arsenal.
Thank you, Arsenal.
Yep, yep.
Nobody ever talks about it because it was so ultra limited, and it really didn't end up having that big an impact with what they put in it. But unless it's something reprinted to that limited a quantity, it's going to tank if it was really only worth something because there was just one printing and not a lot of people played it, but the people that did absorbed it all out of the marketplace. That's where the investment is really important, is why is it worth something? The more playable it is in the more formats and across the more, you know, the larger player bases. You know, if it's only a standard legal card, it rotates, it's worthless because there's no true demand. It's played in, you know, EDH, it's played in Pauper, it's played in, you know, casual, which nobody even really talks about that anymore. But don't forget, there's always going to be more casual players than competitive players. And so that's a very important thing as well. It's just you to look at that. Where is the actual demand? And that's also why playing is so important, because it's so much easier to look at that when you actually go, oh, Sol Ring. Oh, my goodness. I want to get that first turn every time.
Is it good that they're reprinting as much as they are, though, in the current marketplace?
If you think about it, if a new player wants to get in, play with their friends, been playing for years, and they buy a, you know, $30 Commander deck, that's not that bad investment. Then they sit down and play, and they get their head handed to them. They go, okay, well, all right, fair enough. I just got started. My friends have all these cards. I'm going to buy some cards too. Oh, Lord, how much did it just, you know, did I just spend? My wife's going to kill me. What am I going to go without this week? I can't afford to play this game. Well, how many new players are we going to have? How large is the market going to continue to grow? So the reprints keep the barrier to entry at a reasonable level and also serves the need of those new players. We get so many new players, they're going to absorb those cards. So as long as the game is continuing to grow, reprints are mandatory to keep the game from dying, actually. It's just, they have to be careful. And from my perspective, I feel that Wizards has actually been fairly realistic on limiting the printings of things. There's a few things I actually think they should reprint that they haven't, as a lot of people are joking about, you know, Commander 2017, that they threw in everything but the kitchen finks. You know, that card, that's an example, you know, that's an example of a card that really needs to get reprinted because people can't afford to play it.
So the $1 million question then is, as a vendor, from where you sit, you see Magic going through, is it growing consistently in proportion to the amount of reprints, the amount of product that WotC is trying to introduce to the marketplace?
I think so, because they're also introducing the game through several different online platforms with the various different games, electronic games, So they're getting a lot of people into it, and they're exposing more people to what it is and the potential of it. So I think the game is growing. It's just the competition for that new customer base is also, that's why it's so important to solidify your own market, your piece of the market, or, you know, your local economy, or whatever you've put into it that you need to get back out. That's why it's important for you to, support the local players and to interact with, with a group that you can basically get what you need out of it as well, not just for playing, but for trading or for, buying and selling.
Now, I guess it's a pertinent topic because Modern Masters 20 has been revealed. It's going to be released. So there's obviously, whenever this time, talk about their collections and the value of their collections. As a big, you talked about this a little bit. Maybe you can expand further. You know, when the barrier of entry is decreased, that drives up, the most important thing is it drives interest into the game, that more people are able to now play the game. Do you have a statement about, for people that are asking, well, my valued, I had to spend all this money on some of these cards and then they're reprinted, and this kind of like feel bad, feeling that they have. Does it impact you more or less? Like, is it more of a negative, or is it a positive, or just a net neutral in these instances?
That is a really good question. Wizards had tried to address that in the recent past with their rotation policy for Standard. And their main goal was to avoid that slap in the face to the player, especially the new player, because Standard really, it's not just new players, but it's the most important way for a new player to be able to get into the game and actually compete and learn with the smaller card pool, and to just, almost immediately lose the value of what you put into it. And not just with, okay, this deck is no longer tier one, that's always going to happen. But that rotation just completely voided the value of my collection, and I can't even use these to trade off to build a new deck. Well, that's why, they changed the block sizes. They changed the rotation time a little bit. I think it's more gentle now. Even if the reprints aren't standard legal and it affects people on a larger basis, it's important that if you play what you enjoy, you're never going to feel bad about it. If you got that time with your friends, and that's really, you got that experience at the Grand Prix or that pre-release, those experiences are what get people into the game and keep them into the game. The value up and down, people are going to complain, but they're always going to complain. You can't make everybody happy, but when somebody truly enjoys the game long term, they're gonna just get used to it and figure out how they can be happy with that dynamic of it.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I mean, we on another cast, I also am on the Goldfish cast, this topic did come up. And, you have to look at it at the end of the day that it's a game, and it's kind of something that you sign up for, what you kind of alluded to there, that, if people are invested into the game, and I'm going to keep using your words here because I think that's a really great point that no other, even other big vendors, didn't really talk about, even if they do believe it, we haven't really discussed that in depth. If you're invested in the game and the success of the game, you're kind of okay with these little hits from, here and there, as long as people are drawn to the game and interested and now are able to buy into the game.
Exactly. And you know how many times I've heard years later, somebody said, "Oh my God, I found this old deck. It's worth so much money now." Well, you know what? Sometimes it's holding on to something, you end up winning. It's a really neat part of the game, actually. And then they start telling stories about what they used to do with that deck and why they held on to it. And you realize they won even more just by that experience.
Yeah. So with as it relates to Modern Masters 2017, a lot of questions are going around regarding the supply. Do you have any input or anything you can sort of like illuminate as far as what the supply is looking like for Modern Masters 2017? Is this an instance where we have, I don't know, Abram, if you're paid attention at all to what was going around, but there was talk of like five times the quantity of Modern Masters 2015. And then there was, oh no, it's going to be super limited. I mean, there was just rumors abound. So Do you have any sort of can you provide some clarity as to what the supply is looking like?
Yeah, this is a hot topic. We need some insight.
A lot of this is going to be supposition, but from my experience, and like I said, I've been doing this for 24 years, so I've seen a lot of decisions that Wizards have made over the years. And for the last several years, they've actually, it looks like they've been really careful about overprinting, because they did that on some of the earlier Commander decks, and it really kind of backfired. And so lately, they've seemed to take a trend of where they're getting it out there. They're making sure that there's demand before they release more. And if there's not a lot of demand, they just stop. I mean, I can't guarantee that, but I'm sure that 2017 is going to be so popular that there will be a second wave. I'm guessing at least a second wave. Beyond that, I don't know, because they didn't really keep releasing the Eternal Masters or the last, you know, Modern Masters over and over and over again. They did, you know, a little bit here and there. Some of the distributors may have played a little part in that, kind of, you know, ferreted a little bit of a way, and then kind of went, oh, look, we found some more. We're going to charge you only 30% more.
Right.
But in the scheme of things, when the distributors feel that the demand is there to where they can actually kind of gouge, and I know that's it seems mean, and it is to a certain degree, but it really just tells a tale that this is a really strong market. Like I said, yeah, there's a lot of upturns and downturns, but as long as people play it because they enjoy it, and this set is going to help people enjoy the game immensely. It's not just value, it's why is it value? Go back to what I said about the real drive behind this game is the playing and the enjoyment of it. And if you think about what you can do with all the different cards in this set, how many formats you can play them in, it's just so many people are going to have so much fun. We're going to get so many new players into Modern. The Commander players won't, there won't be a pauper version of the game as much played. I actually, believe it or not, I see that where people they can't really afford a real deck because it's all of the key staples are so expensive. You know, the fetches, people playing without fetches, you know, playing without, you know, Liliana the Veils, just so many cards that are coming out. They're going to get absorbed in the marketplace. Yes, the prices are going to settle. They're going to settle based off of true demand, which is healthy for a marketplace. So even though there's all this guessing game going on, I really feel that Wizards is understanding that you don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And overprinting and devaluing their own product is not what it looks like they've been their goal is. And no matter what they say, you have to look at their actions. And knock on wood, so far their actions have been pretty consistent on that. So I'm, as a vendor and a player and somebody that's supporting, you know, a local community and a greater community when possible, I'm feeling really good about this.
Does it seem like let me rephrase this. It feels like they have less of an interest in the collectability aspect of the game these days, and more of an interest in people playing the game, which kind of converts into more business for them, right? I mean, they're serving two purposes here. Do you agree with that? Because, you know, like, are we moving towards the days of $100 cards? Well, I should say new cards, you know, there's not going to be $100, you know, contemporary print of a card, like, you know, something that comes out in a future set, in a contemporary future, you know, set that's going currently, since we'll say past Return of Ravnica, you know, these cards aren't going to hit $100, you know, before we have things like Tarmogoyf and such, one, due to the limited supply and also due to their playability, but the reprinting and the reprinting and the reprinting that they're sort of hacking down the values of the cards. Do you see that as occurring as that's something that maybe they're even trying to do, is focus more on people playing and less so on the collectability? Obviously, you know, you have the reserve list, which that's its own cross section of collectible demand, but just the day-to-day aspect of the game, is that where we're headed? Less collectability and more focus on the game? Or do you still think we're going to have, you know, $100 cards?
I think that, yes, they're definitely focusing on people playing, but that goes back to what I said, is the reason why it's collectible is because people played in the first place and they enjoyed it. Without more people enjoying it, there aren't all those collectors. But to answer your question, as far as the value of the newer cards, you have to look at, you know, foil versions. You have to look at limited alternate art, special, you know, extended art promotional versions, you know, judge promos, something that, you know, has a lower print run that has more of a bling factor that people want to collect. The Japanese foil version or the Russian foil version of that, you know, that new top tier card that actually seeing play in Modern and Legacy. That's the, that's where those newer $100 cards are going to come from. They're not going to come from the non-premium version that's released in the booster pack. That actually never used to happen. People don't realize that how much had to happen for those cards to go up in the first place. Tarmogoyf, and I kid you not, I can say this about so many cards, were sitting in my display case at way undervalued, you know, in pile of, you know, 20 to 30 of them just sitting there, people going, why would they print a card that bad? Well, because nobody figured it out yet. Right. You know, and that actually happened a while.
I really do. You're not kidding, because I do remember the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, Tarmogoyf, I actually was joking with somebody about how many bad cards you would have to put in your deck to make it good. And we listed every single card that ended up being played in Time Spiral Block in the trial series that Wizards did for, it was actually the first time the trials were, the Grand Prix trials were actually allowed to be done in stores. And that's actually because they pushed people to play at the stores with those trials, that actually helped make Tarmogoyf the $100 card or the $200 card it was for a limited time. So like I said, hand in hand, play goes with the value. On the newer cards, just have to realize that special versions of it, give it a little bit of time, wait for, you know, not the rotation, but for people to stop buying box after box and the redemptions that's to keep getting cashed in for the availability to go down, because the market is going to absorb very large quantities very quickly. So that's about the best I can say in regards to the newer value of the rares and stuff like that.
Does that mean that Magic moves more towards being, you know, really being a volume business when you have newer cards being worth less? Therefore, you're talking about, in order to scale, sustain and scale, then we're talking about basically a volume business at that point. Is that true?
Yes, on Standard and the newer release cards, it is a volume business. But because there are so many people that play Standard, it is already a volume business. You just have to figure how to tap into it. And that's where the different philosophies work. You know, if you want to buy and sell quickly in large quantities, you're probably going to be dealing in Standard cards. You're going to be dealing in those the cards that just got reprinted, that they got reprinted because there's such a huge demand for them that has not been met yet. And so you have to get in, get those multiples and flip them as they're getting absorbed. And the true price is kind of, you know, ticking up a little bit once it gets to that, you know, okay, now that's a good margin for me. All right, I'm going to go ahead and sell those 100 copies. All right, I made my money. What's the next card I'm going to do this on? That's where you can to do the larger volume and quicker turnover is on the newer cards, the newer reprints, where there's that huge, huge demand and that the vendors and the players can absorb large quantities of them. The old stuff, they're so expensive and they're always going to be a niche market. It's a lot harder to flip those quicker. And so that's where you play more the long game on.
I want to be able to get to this topic to make sure we are really great. We talked about a lot of different things, or, you know, the kind of the investment vehicle, the different aspects and opportunities in Magic. And you talk, you know, even Tarkan discussed, you know, our personal view. And, you know, we've discussed this a lot on different casts between Tarkan and I, even with other vendors, that, you know, at the end of the day, and you kind of just touched on this, that whatever you're doing is more comfortable for you. You kind of have to know that specific, I guess, niche of the market. And we have here, so with the growing power of the casual and EDH and the Commander player base, how is this affecting the market and finance? Because even on your site, and we touched on this earlier, that your site definitely has a very strong buy list in terms of these specific cards. And, you know, your notes here talking about the player base, I think is really important and something that I wanted to make sure we talked about.
Well, I think that it's One other thing I hadn't mentioned, but it goes into what you're asking about, and that is with the large amount of people out there, we'll just call them vendors in general, anybody trying to sell a card as a vendor. There are so many vendors in the marketplace now, and they all want to have those cards that everybody else wants to buy. So the players absorb quite a bit, and they hold on to them, and so we have value there. But we're also now gaining value just from the actual secondary market of vendors buying to stock their stores.
Yes.
So that's a great point. huge value to the game. So if everybody believes that this is a staple playable card, they have to stock it for their customers. So it's not just the actual players driving it, but it's also the vendors who are trying to stock it. I actually sell a tremendous amount of cards to what I refer to as restockers. And I'm not trying to be derogatory at all. Everybody buys from everybody that they can buy from if they feel that they can make a good margin on it, or they need to make it, they need to restock it and the price is going up. They need to make that investment. And so players, you know, that whole dynamic to the market, it's first comes the demand, which is from the players. Then there's the increased demand from the people that want to have it in their trade binder, that want to have it up, you know, on eBay or that vendor site or another vendor site or their own website. And so once again, if you focus on, you know, the medium to long term, the playability and what is going to have that demand, that's where you're going to always have a good investment. You're going to be able to go back to your collection and pull out just money, fistfuls of money from commons and uncommons that you didn't really pay much for because you got them in booster packs, or you had them from that sealed deck event, or, you know, from the pre-release you played in. But like I said, first comes the play, then comes everything else. And so if you focus on those cards, like I said, even the vendors are helping to change the market. And I'm not talking about buyouts. That's dangerous. Be very careful about those price spikes that are not true. And that's something we can talk about if we have time, but that's a whole nother topic. So did I kind of cover what you were looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
you were missing casuals, right? Like the casual market as opposed to the tournament market, right?
Right. Yeah. I kind of feel that, you know, people are realizing and coming to the conclusion now that that is kind of the most stable way to play the game. And even with reprints and of that nature, you can still continue to play the game and not really worry about what's going on in standard, modern, this, that, and the other thing. As long as you're able to play your EDH commander, you know, your casual decks, you can continue to do that. And there's value there.
There's huge value. There is huge value in being a tournament player if you can afford to hold on to your cards for any length of time. And I don't mean until it rotates, but if you want to play competitively and you want to play a deck, how many decks are you going to have? How many cards are you going to have to be able to play competitively? Realistically, the best players I have ever played with that I have ever seen do well consistently have always had all access to all of the cards they could ever want to play with. Now, either borrowing from friends and play groups or putting together own collections, when they win that tournament and they get that store credit or win the booster packs, they go, oh, well, I need this player set. I need a player set of all of the top cards. And so that way they can play, they can change with the metagame. And so if you do that, if you can afford to do that, and something goes up in value, well, you have four of that card. If that deck becomes the new hot deck, you have the whole entire deck already that you got at a lower value, and you can either play it or you can now sell it at a profit. It's just not easy for everybody to be able to afford to get into, you know, collecting player sets of everything in standard, because when the rotation comes, you have to get out about 3 months in advance of the bigger invested cards, you know, the more valuable cards, or that's where you start to lose money. But long term, if you just keep everything, you're able to put your collection together to where you can afford to just hold on to it long term, that's where you make so much money, because you've got player sets of everything, you know. And it's one more way to do it, that's all.
Would you just agree that so again, when we're talking about things like these reprint sets, would you agree that generally what happens in the economics of it, and just this is more of just a nuts and bolts economic magic economics, you know, kind of question for the viewers, when they let's take Liliana the Veil, let's say a reprint of Liliana the Veil slashes the price, whether that be in the original and the reprint, the price drops. Assuming that that does at least create some kind of bump in demand, whether that be from the existing base or ideally new players coming into the format, then value shifts from Liliana over to a non-reprint. Let's say Eidolon of the Great Revel was a good one that a lot of people were talking about recently. So that the values that drop in one area then move to those cards that were maybe had built-in sort of ceilings on them because a lot of the value of the deck was absorbed by other staples. Do you think, is that true? Is that sort of kind of I don't want to say a rule, but kind of a phenomenon that typically happens with these kinds of situations with reprints?
It can. I've actually seen reprints raise prices on cards that didn't get reprinted solely because people can afford to play the deck now. Like, for instance, exactly. For Modern Jund, you need Liliana the Veil. You can't really play the deck. Now, all of a sudden, Dark Confidant might go back up. If people put in, as your example, Eidolon of the Great Revel, that probably not the best example for that deck. But let's just say that that was in the deck. Well, there's no reprint of it. Now that deck sees a lot more play. That card and any other card in that deck that wasn't very valuable is now had increasing demand and is going to raise in price. And then with more people playing that deck, Liliana is just going to go back up anyways. So overall, as long as it's not, a real easy card to get and that it's just too available so that it can't really drive, the price up for a very long time, it actually, I think, usually stabilizes prices long term because it gets more people playing that card and then playing cards that you need to play against it as well as the other cards in the deck. So it's I think, as long as, like I said, the key is they don't flood the marketplace with easy reprints. If they were to put Liliana the Veil in like a dual deck, that would be a very bad mistake. And that would be very tragic for its value.
So how would you advise someone who's looking at something like Modern Masters and goes, how do I navigate investing in Modern? Would you recommend that they wait for release and then find the floors of these cards once the supply, they reach maximum supply, and then start buying those cards in hopes that those cards are going to bounce back and regain some value? Or would you advise that they move towards the non-reprinted cards as those, like we just mentioned, are likely to pick up in value due to accessibility?
That's a great question. It's something everybody always asks is, how do I know what's going to happen? Something I've actually done, I went one PTQ season. It's been a little while since people have heard that term, and it was for Extended, basically the original Modern, and I was going to an area I hadn't been to before. So I actually did a search on Wizards of the Coast archive for the top 8 deck results from PTQs for that area, and I actually looked at the archetypes and the decks specifically that dominated and the players that dominated in that area. And I actually took a deck and a sideboard prepared against those, and I did really well. It was very successful. And so you can actually look at Grand Prix results. You can look at Pro Tour results for decks and archetypes that you're looking to invest in. So for Modern, look at some of the most challenging Grand Prix that happened. Not the ones where something else more important was going on, so that was kind of the weaker players showed up. Look at the top pro deck list. Look at the top 16 deck list. Not just the top 8. Look at the top 16. Look at the ones undefeated after day one and see, what are those decks? Wow. That deck barely sees play. Why does it barely see play? Because it's too expensive for most people. Oh, wait, Liliana is getting reprinted. This is getting reprinted. So people are going to be able to play that deck again. That deck is really good. It's proven that the pros will play it given the opportunity, and they'll do really well with it. So I'm going to invest in those cards that go into those decks, or that even sometimes hate out that deck, like Blood Moon. For instance, if Jun becomes very accessible again and starts to dominate because, well, it's an amazing deck, well, Blood Moon is a great counter to the deck. So, kind of looking at a little bit of those dynamics, doing a little bit of research, and like I said, following the best, the most successful pros results, not because they're a big name, but because they put the time and effort in to figure out what was the best and they could play it the best. So that kind of helps foreshadow what's to come. And that's actually, I think, true. You can go back into older formats as well and actually look at old decks that used to dominate in Standard, 15 years ago, like when they first started Standard, and you can invest in some of those cards because they were good for a reason and they're still good. They just might be forgotten for now.
But I guess from a general economic standpoint, would you, if you had to lean on one side or the other, would you recommend more so, hey, yeah, I would pick up these Modern Masters reprints when they reach floors, or would you more so advise someone look at the non-reprinted cards as far as just strictly things that you think you expect to go up?
Right now, things have already started going up because the spoiler is complete for the Modern Masters 2017 reprint. So everything that didn't get reprinted, the price is stabilizing on and going back up. So if you really want, right now to look at what to get, you want to get the cards that weren't reprinted that are going to go into the decks that people can afford to get now. And then as the product is opened and gets out there and prices stabilize on the new reprints, you look at something that just is undervalued at the moment and buy those up. And that is going to happen as soon as everybody opens up their boxes and everybody offers them all out for sale at the same time. That's when the true starting price is accurate. But then remember, if it's a good card and there's real demand, it will only go up from there.
I keep telling people that damnation. I can't wait.
Yes. Oh, my Lord. Yes.
I want a stack of them.
Yes. Oh, yes. And not just because it looks hot.
Oh, yeah. That's part of it. But
Yeah, I think we gotta start tying things up.
I was just about to say that. We're kind of all on a schedule. Let's kind of move into the wrap up here. So I get, again, for every cast, especially with the vendors, we like to talk about, cards that we are looking at in terms of, purchasing or acquiring. Do you have any for us and just a brief context to along with those?
Well, specific cards, it's so hard to just pick one.
Because definitely hard.
I've been, playing for almost the entire length of the game, and I think in terms of decks and archetypes and formats, and really, honestly, I think right now the best thing to buy for, and take a chance on are actually commons and uncommons. And so, like, for instance, in Modern Masters 2017, those are going to be the lowest prices because everybody's going to get the most of them. And I mean, we have Path to Exile, which has been reprinted a million times, but it is always going to be a staple. I say get them. They're going to go down really low. Pick those up because they're just amazing. They're always going to be amazing.
Yep.
There's cards like Molten Rain, which are very niche cards. If they go really low, pick those up only dirt cheap because Land Destruction hasn't been a real viable archetype for a while. I think there's a chance that could change, but it's never going to come back the way it was when people remember the actual, archetype as a deck. So anything that doesn't have a wide use, don't worry about it as much. Look at this is in every single deck. Look at, that, like I said, Path to Exile. Look at, it's funny. I've priced the whole set out in my mind. And
yeah.
I'm at a loss for words. But that's what I'd say. Really, look at the commons and uncommons and look at the ones that are in at least three different decks in any format. Buy them and buy a lot of them.
Like, I'm sure your stack of Inquisition of Code times the size of your stack of Damnation.
Yes. Inquisition is an amazing card. It's thought sees without the negative. And in the speedy format, like Modern, it's so valuable. It's just right now, Black has not been dominating. That archetype has not been dominating. But as soon as a deck does well with that in there, and I can see that happening with the recent success of the Tarmogoyf deck again, Inquisition completely just stalls that deck out for very little cost to yourself. That's a really good example, actually. I'm glad you brought it up.
I'm here for you.
Man, that's awesome to hear you say, Avram, because I know, like, you know, myself and I know Chaz also, you know, we've been sort of kind of echoing the same thing that it's, I tell you, some of these commons and uncommons are just going to really fly under people's radar. And, you know, there's going to be some, I think personally that that's where the best opportunity is going to be with the set is in the commons and uncommons. Because there's going to be so much, there's going to be so much activity around the staple rares and mythics that I feel like there's going to be really just, there's going to be some of these commons and uncommons are just going to, they're just going to fly out under the radar, and they're going to get so cheap that there's going to be a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah. Now, normally we would talk about interests and stocks that we see, but very recently there's been issues with TCG player sellers and Crystal Commerce. So I kind of want to just stay away from that right now, yeah, because there's a lot of wacky things going on. So I just want to see when that settles, because this does happen before. And then all these cards, like a million cards increase, and then everyone thinks like everything's spiking to the stratosphere when it's just, you know, kind of back end error. So I'm glad we kind of stuck with Modern Masters 2017. So thanks, Avram. We do have just a couple listener questions, and then we'll wrap things up. So would love to hear whether outlets like Adventures On feel the need to support prices on staples when something like Modern Masters 2017 comes out.
And I think by that, he kind of clarified, like, for example, let's say Force of Will is released in Eternal Masters. And, you know, in order to keep the price from cratering, a vendor like yourself or Star City will basically set a floor by going, okay, hey, everyone, we're going to buy these at $70. That essentially sets the price floor for the card. Is that sort of what, you know, do you guys sort of do that? Or is that kind of a way to support pricing?
Sometimes. It's also, to go back to what I said about the long-term stock of the game.
Got it.
We're not going to sell as many copies of Force of Will as we're going to sell, obviously, you know, Inquisition of Kozilek or Path to Exile, but we're going to sell them consistently. There's going to be consistent demand. And so the value is always going to be, you know, kept up just from that demand, but we're not going to keep getting them in. Not everybody's going to have those cards to sell us. So we're looking at, okay, yeah, we're going to pay a little bit more now, but we're going to have that stock. We're going to be the go-to source for, you know, the cards. That's why my buy list is so full of the playable staples from all these different formats, is because if I always have the cards people want, you know, of course it needs to be at a fair price, they're going to come to me, and they know our service is going to be good. We're very fast to ship. We ship protected, you know, we package well, and then we take care of people if something goes wrong. And so part of that service is actually availability.
Interesting. Okay. So there is a motivation to keep a card at a healthy price, but also a lot of times it's just, they want a long-term play to have plenty in stock.
Yes.
Awesome. And then one other quick one, same person. Are they buying staples on higher supply, or long-term holds are just turning inventory?
It's always a little bit of each. Now, I know that's kind of a cop-out of an answer, but let me give you a better example. For instance, when Modern, they banned every good cheap draw spell, and what was left? Serum Visions. I actually was stocking and made sure I kept in stock over 500 Serum Visions at any given moment for, I think, over a year straight. Now, that may seem a bit excessive, but the sales, I was literally selling, you know, I could sell 50 in a day, easy. And so I was buying, I was sorting out old stock to pull more out. I was going into deep into archives of stuff that, you know, was over, you know, that we couldn't fit into our excess inventory because we had so much of it. And, you know, I literally was pulling thousands of literally, I'm not joking, thousands of that card out of the woodwork just to keep them in stock. And so, I mean, obviously that's an extreme example, but really, that's kind of what it is when there's some, the playability and the demand and the market supports something, if you don't try to meet it, then your customers are going to go elsewhere. So for a vendor, it's stock image is huge. Pricing is huge. It's our obligation to buy back as well. So it's kind of all of those things. But first, if we don't have it, we can't do everything else.
Incredible. Yeah, that's, it's insane. And I'm sure you have other examples
Yes, that's just a dream one.
Right. I
actually did that with Tarmogoyf once, not to the thousands.
but although going I'm into, sure you wish you did.
Yes. It was actually another investment dynamic that I hadn't mentioned is when decks are seasonal, archetypes are seasonal, if you can, a couple of months in advance, look at what happens to be low in stock and low in price, that's a staple for that format, and kind of pick up some of those cards when that format rolls around and everybody looks to get them. Well, there wasn't a deep stock on that card, so the price is going to go up because that demand is going up. And that happened with Tarmogoyf one time. It was about 2 months before the new extended season. I'm like, okay, what are the best decks? Okay, what are the cards? What are my stock like on them? Where did all the Tarmogoyfs go? I found 7 Tarmogoyfs at that time, literally on any and all sites combined. Every single major vendor and TCG player, everybody. I'm like, where did they all go? And why are they only this low price? Now, I won't say the price because it's been a while, not relevant. So I actually went up and I bought all 7 of those copies from every single vendor I found them at. And then I went up to eBay and I bought every buy it now at the full price and put a bid on every single auction for Tarmogoyf. And for 2 weeks straight, I put together 60 Tarmogoyfs in 2 weeks doing that. And the price raised just in those 2 weeks by about $15. And by the end, and then when that extended rolled around, and then by the time that extended season ended, it had doubled in value from when I first noticed that trend of the low inventory. And of course I was out, but I was able to take care of my customers and made a healthy profit at the same time. Now, that's not a buyout. That was an actual low inventory card that was about to be in demand, and I just made sure I got enough copies to take care of my customers. So that's a huge investment opportunity if you can know enough about the game and do the research and kind of look forward, a couple of months, or look forward to that next season of Modern or the next standard, going into states, regionals, the higher demand events.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Avron,
One more quick question.
Go ahead.
That's so much good stuff. I just want to wrap this on one final note. Last question. Is Magic growing at a healthy rate? And is it a bright future for Magic?
I think it's growing. It's become part of popular culture now. There's people who know what it is that don't play. That's huge. As far as healthy, as long as Wizards continues the current reprint policies, don't flood the market, they continue to support it, continues to grow globally like it is, I think it's very healthy. But we do need to be careful about, like, investors is not a problem. Collectors, people absorbing things to make money, that's not a problem. It's when it's turns into the sports card mentality of, I'm going to buy 1,000 of these and sell them at a 2% markup the first chance I get. That is what makes it unhealthy. And we have to be careful about, pushing the barriers too much on that side. Like I said, overall investment, not a problem, but you got to be careful that you're doing it for the right reasons.
I think that is a very good note to leave it off at. Some people need to hear that statement.
Yeah. Yep.
Again, for everyone who's listening, thanks for joining us, Avron. This has been fantastic. If any of you have not used Adventures On, I really suggest you do, because their buy list system is great. Their all-around service is fantastic. So you should really be using their service. I mean, I can't say it enough. Other than that, where can they find you on the internet, Avron?
Well, www.adventureson.com. I also sell on blackorder.com.
eBay. Or
I'm sorry, I apologize. As far as Facebook, we do a lot of our support through, blackborder.com for the articles. We're the vendor that sells on their site, so the business comes to us that way. And then our store, Adventures in Comics and Games. We don't do a whole lot of active social media for the actual Adventures On site, which may sound strange, but it's just, we're pretty much about the nuts and bolts of the game. Support the players. We're by players for the players, for the further support of the game, and I think that pretty much says it all.
Cool. Yeah, I'm over at the MTG Finance Central Facebook page. I'm an admin over there. You can chat with me there. On Twitter, I'm at @_TARK, T-A-R-K. You can chat with me over there too. And I'm working with QS.
Awesome. Yeah, Twitter's a great place to find me at ChazVMT. Write articles for Quiet Speculation, podcast, insider articles, you name it, I do it. And on the MTG Goldfish podcast, Avram, we have to do this again. This has been phenomenal. I mean, truly, this is a cast for the ages.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to get my opinion out there. And you guys were fantastic. I really appreciate the questions and just such a positive attitude. You know, you guys do good work.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, please come back. We'd love to have you on again.
Yep, we need to do this again. All right, everyone, thanks for tuning in. Hopefully everyone enjoys this as much as to get Avram's perspective. We will do this again next time. So this is going to be the QS Cast signing out.
See you guys.
Take care.